Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the IB Green Minds podcast. My name is Phoebe Scott, and this week I'm joined by Martin Berg, Head of Natural Capital Impact Strategy at HSBC Pollination Climate Asset Management. Martin is a globally renowned leader in climate and environmental finance, having conceptualised and led low-carbon investments in the public and private sector for more than 20 years. Martin joined Pollination from the European Investment Bank based in Luxembourg, where he was the head of the Environmental Funds and Climate Finance Policy Unit. He also served on the board of directors for the Green for Growth Fund in Luxembourg and was a vice president at Bank of America Merrill Lynch in London, responsible for the carbon finance activities of Merrill Lynch. Martin was also a carbon finance specialist at the New York-based environmental investment firm RNK Capital LLC and started his career at the OECD Climate Change Unit in Paris, as well as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in Bonn. Martin, thank you so much for joining me today on the Green Minds podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Phoebe.
Great. So I thought it would be useful to start off by talking about your career to date. How did your prior career lead you to Pollination, and what did you feel in particular attracted you to Pollination?
Yeah, you were just reading my biography and reading it in hindsight, obviously it looks like it was a very clear direction, but perhaps always when you're in your own career, it doesn't actually feel that way. So I started off, as you said, at the Climate Change Convention in Bonn, and that was really as a student. And back then, that was just after the Kyoto Conference, so where the Kyoto Protocol in 1997 was agreed. At that point, I had a friend who said, look, why don't you work for this UN organization? They do really interesting stuff, and they need people, and they always hire students for the conferences. And this is how I started, and the only qualification was really to speak English at that point. And I did this, and then I got really interested, and I thought, wow, this is really fascinating. And I was always fascinated by climate change, or by the subject of climate change, not necessarily by the environmental dimension that we see now at the moment, but really by all the combination of that. It touches on everything, right? It touches the economy, it touches the environment, it touches society. It's a question of equity around the world. And then I actually thought, okay, I'm starting to also focus on this in my studies and then to make a career out of that. So I started off my first job really then after university was the OECD Climate Change Unit. That was pre-carbon market. That was at the early 2000s. And there we looked a lot, okay, how could actually carbon be priced? There were the flexible mechanism under the Kyoto Protocol, and the OECD was doing a lot of thinking how to set up this mechanism. There were lots of conferences, but it took until 2004 until this market was really kicking off. I, in between, did a master's degree in New York, and after that, I started working for a hedge fund, and I just met this hedge fund manager as part of my studies, and he said, look, we want to really build this market. And what we did there is really to do the first carbon projects under the Kyoto Protocol. Back then, it was possible to generate credits in emerging countries or in transition economies, and we would finance those projects on the ground and then generate the credits that then can be sold in the market. I did this then, I moved back to Europe, did this for Merrill Lynch, and then when the market started to turn the other direction in the late 2000s, I really had to look for something new, basically. And back then, the European Investment Bank was tasked to sell 300 million EUAs, which at that point was actually the largest amount of carbon credits ever sold for the EU member states. And I helped them to do this. And through this activity, I came to the ERB. I had to then really reorient myself a little bit and also wanted to do something different and worked at the ERB after that in a team that was really thinking through environmental investments from the equity side. And one of the big topics was really to look into what we call new sectors. So how could nature be used in a much different way? And in the year 2012 already, we done our first investments in this area, and we built a whole kind of investment theme around that, into funds, into projects. In the end, we were running an initiative called the Natural Capital Financing Facility, which still exists, which is an EIB EU project to find bankable projects in this area. And I always thought, well, after 10 years, it was really time for me to see whether this is not something that could be scaled up and whether this is not something that could be done and also in private sector. And through the whole work on carbon, I actually knew one of the co-founders of Pollination. And when he founded Pollination at the end of 2019, I contacted him and I just tried to understand what they were doing. I said, look, we really want to scale up all these new environmental markets, such as natural capital. And I was really interested by it. And so one word came to the other, and he convinced me to start in London to build out the investment side for Pollination with a team.
I think you touched on a really important point there. It sounds like throughout your career, you've been fully aware of the all-encompassing aspects of climate change and focus upon different aspects of it at different points in your career. That's really interesting. Touching on the landscape and rhetoric surrounding climate and environmental finance, which you've mentioned slightly in your previous answer, how do you think that's changed since you started your career around 20 years ago?
There are a few trends. I think when I had my first stint, so to speak, really in the private sector on climate, it was much more a niche activity and it was much more seen as an investment opportunity. It wasn't seen as much back then, at least in the finance sector, as an opportunity to kind of do good and do well. It was really seen as, wow, this could be an enormously big market and we should be part of that. That was the kind of the private sector view. And then there was a more, let's say, the NGO view or the public view is, look, we really obviously need to get the finance sector, the private sector involved, and we can only do that by setting incentives. So that was kind of the first. And I think now it has really changed a lot. I think the big change I can really see is, firstly, it's a much bigger issue for the finance sector. Climate, like, as I said, in the mid-2000s, it was really only a few or a handful of people in organizations that were focused on that. Now, with things like, you know, the passport on climate-related disclosure, this is really a big issue. This has become a big board issue. So there's almost probably no CEO in a company at the moment that at least doesn't think, what do we need to do on this issue? And this is really leading now to a very different approach to climate. It's a combination of trying to do the right thing, but also preparing the companies for the risk. So I think it's a combination. There's more awareness about the actually impact. So there's a really, let's say, a hard-nosed approach for many, especially when you look at the finance industry, that it really has an impact. But then there's also this responsibility, which now companies take on, which I didn't see in the mid-2000s. So that when you look, for example, at all the net zero targets, I think this really demonstrates that companies are saying, you know, it used to be that we're saying, this is not our problem. This is the government's problem. We're not responsible for the environment. But that has changed. Now, a lot of companies saying, yes, we have a responsibility. We have our own stakeholders. And in absence of the right regulatory action from governments, we're actually doing our own thing on a voluntary basis. To be honest, it'll be very interesting to see how this continues to develop.
Absolutely. And that ties in nicely to the ethos and aims of Pollination, which was set up to focus on the private sphere and help boards and corporates, especially the private sector, in climate change advisory. Could you please just elaborate a bit more on why Pollination was set up and the core elements of its ethos?
Yeah, but firstly, maybe a bit of background. So Pollination was set up by two co-founders. It was Martin Wilder, who used to be a leading lawyer at Baker McKinsey in Sydney. He teamed up with the former investment banker, Tony O'Sullivan, who found his own advisory business in Australia and then moved back to Europe. And what they thought was missing was, as you said, a private sector-focused company on net zero. That's really the overall goal of the company, to reach net zero. But that doesn't really have a legacy. I think what they felt is that too many players now in the environmental markets that basically have a legacy, maybe advisory firms, maybe large industrial companies, and that if you want to provide unbiased advice, that it is better that you actually don't have this legacy and you can really say we are only focusing on net zero. And the same we're doing on the investment side, that we're really looking for investment opportunities and structures that really lead to net zero. And the two topics for Pollination on the one hand side is transition finance, and on the other hand is natural capital.
What would you say are the major trends in climate change advisory at the moment and the areas that Pollination's clients are most seeking advice upon? You obviously touched upon net zero, but I was wondering if there was anything else that was the top of corporates' minds at the moment.
Yeah, I think you have to ask, why are companies really coming up with net zero strategies? And I think for me, it's twofold, right? So it's really, as I said, the risks of climate change also for a company or a business is becoming much clearer. More and more companies, they're not doing this only to saying we want to do the right thing. They're also seeing it has a huge implication on my supply chain. There's a huge implication on the portfolios I manage for myself or for clients. And I think that's on the one hand side a big driver, but I think we are in a little bit on a change also how the corporation is being seen. What is the function of the corporation? What the responsibilities vis-a-vis and of other stakeholders vis-a-vis the world? And I think this is where kind of this responsibility comes in. And I think the combination of the two is that it's a much, much bigger issue now and as an importance. So I think Tony Blair once said, in the late 2000s, he said, you know, the environment is no longer on the agenda. It is the agenda. Maybe it was a bit early back then, but it's definitely, I think, at the moment, for many CEOs and boards, it is really the agenda. And it's one of the most important topics for them to deal with. And that obviously drives a lot of change. And so when you look at an advisory firm such as Pollination, that offers obviously a lot of opportunities to really help those companies to think through strategies, what should be done, how should this be addressed. But that is really where I think the main opportunities are.
You're right, it's at the forefront of all corporates' minds right now, and it's definitely something that is a bit of an untapped market, or definitely a room for massive growth and expansion as it becomes even more of a focus and the whole agenda, as Tony Blair said as well. Now just turning to your actual precise role as Head of Natural Capital Impact Strategy, which is for the joint venture between HSBC and Pollination. So just to reiterate, its full title is HSBC Pollination Climate Asset Management. What have been your main focus points so far in this role?
Yeah, it's quite a mouthful. So we can call it CAM to keep it short. Yeah, so this was really the first advance of Pollination into the investment side. That natural capital was always seen as one of the big topics we really wanted to develop as an investment theme, and really bringing this much more to the mainstream investment world. And we had many discussions when I was also before I joined, or when I was in the process of joining, what could actually be done? What is the best way of doing this? And one of the options was always, well, why don't we partner with a big player in this, then in really to bring this to the mainstream level. And there was a meeting on the minds when HSBC and Pollination, that was actually before I joined, actually just when I think took the decision to join, but before I formally joined because of the notice period, there was a very good meeting with HSBC, and they really said, look, we want to see that you develop us an idea how we could bring natural capital to the mainstream. And the outcome of those kind of brainstorming discussions was a joint venture between HSBC Asset Management and Pollination. So it's a jointly owned company and an asset management company that exists now since September. And that is now going through the whole regulatory process that is required for an asset management company, but that also now focuses entirely on products related to natural capital. At the moment, those are real asset strategies, i.e. those are in funds or other strategies that would invest in projects on the ground that have a focus on natural capital. We can discuss maybe in a minute what we understand with that. So my role was really, so I was part of the team, the Pollination team that interacted with HSBC to really finalize the joint venture. And then when we incorporated, I moved over and I'm now heading what we call natural capital impact strategies on a day-to-day basis. I'm really thinking through about the positioning of our vehicles on the one hand side, but also most importantly, as part of our investment strategy, we don't want to see impact only as an, let's say, a reporting tool or something where we show nice pictures in an impact report. The whole thesis of both of our vehicles that we are planning is to actually use the impact in order also to create additional returns that are attractive to investors, because we believe we can only bring natural capital to the mainstream if we're offering institutional investors investment vehicles that can both achieve a return, a risk-adjusted return that is in line with what they expect and that is comparable to other investment opportunities that they see, and the impact.
You touched upon a lot of really interesting points there, particularly regarding mainstream natural capital, which is obviously quite nascent at the moment, but will hopefully become really exciting and increasingly mainstreamed as your funds launch. Just going a bit more deeply into the funds themselves. So you've got one fund which is aiming to focus upon natural capital, forestry and agriculture, and the second hopefully focusing upon carbon credits. And obviously these are just a new process and a new investment proposal for your investor base. And also for our listeners who might have limited knowledge of how these funds will work, could you please explain this in a bit more detail?
Yeah, so at the moment these are really, just to be clear, those are really strategies that we're developing that we're obviously discussing now in an early stage with investors, but we're still at an earlier stage with that. But what we're proposing is really to find investment, real asset investment strategies that allow investors to, through these strategies, to invest in projects on the ground that are focused on natural capital. The way we kind of look at this at the moment is natural capital is, you know, it's obviously on the one hand that you can define it very broadly at anything that is related to nature. And then obviously you would have a very, very large investment strategy. So we're trying to narrow it down. So we're focusing on sectors such as agriculture. We're focusing on forest related projects. And then we're focusing on mostly land. Some could be also blue or ocean based projects that derive their revenue streams much more from the impacts of natural capital. So that could be carbon related revenue streams. That could be biodiversity related revenue streams, that could be water related revenue streams. And that, in our view, is different than in some of the more in the agriculture and forestry side, where most of the revenue streams come from more traditional, the underlying yield from the agriculture projects or the timber revenues from a forest project. And so by combining these things into one strategy, we're really trying to allow institutional investors to have, on the one hand side, a very stable and long-term revenue stream Then, but on the other hand, also the real first exposure to those revenue streams that are really mostly derived from natural capital, i.e. biodiversity and carbon. And the combination of those, we believe, could actually be a very attractive investment opportunity.
When you've been discussing these strategies with investors, do they have any specific concerns surrounding, as you mentioned, this relatively untapped space? And how do you allay these?
Yeah, I think the main two concerns are really what's new here. If you speak to somebody who's investing in agriculture and forestry projects already, so say, what's new? We're already investing into nature all the time. We just called it forestry and agriculture. You just call it something different. And they'll be saying, yes, that is true, but we're trying to actually go beyond the traditional forestry and agriculture projects. We're really trying to enter only in those projects where we see a positive change on the ground, where biodiversity is incorporated in one way or the other, maybe more as an impact or maybe actually as a revenue stream. And then the other ones that are really concerned and saying, I don't know how you make money with that, because when we have looked on for payment for ecosystem services, those are very small markets at the moment. How can you build a sizable strategy? And they'll be saying that is true, but we do believe that this market is really ready to kick off further. We see it in the UK, lots of discussions on new ideas how to incorporate biodiversity. If you look into Australia, we see the same. If you're looking even in the US, there are lots of new mechanisms that are coming up. So we really try to tell those investors, by the combination with the forestry, you get a lot of exposure to these new type of financing forms, which we truly believe will actually be the future. In a way, you could say this strategy is really something that should prepare investors now for a future investment opportunity that we only believe will grow further and will become much clearer over the next years, probably also driven by a lot more of the, now we discussed it, right, all the pressures from companies, from stakeholders, but also from governments. When you look, for example, at all the COVID recovery plans, if they have one thing in common is that they involve ideas for green projects. None of the governments will have a lot of money to actually put their own money into this. So they're all thinking about new mechanisms, how some of the environmental externalities could be priced in a different way through regulation, through incentives and so on.
It's really key to be able to mobilize private sector capital in this space, because governments can develop policy and mechanisms, but it's obviously really on private sector finance as well. So it's really exciting that you're putting this in front of investors. And I was also just curious, is there any geographical focus to your strategies at the moment, or are you thinking on quite a broad basis?
In general, I think we want to be a global actor as a wider firm. For this first strategy on natural capital, we now decided that we're mostly focusing on developed markets. And the reason being is that A, we believe this is something that investors feel more comfortable with given where the market is. So in a way, you have to eliminate risks where you can, and taking this immediately to emerging markets would be very challenging, at least on a very large scale. And then the second reason for that is really that we're also seeing there are a lot of opportunities for natural capital related projects in developed markets such as Europe, the US or in Australia. If you look now in Europe, and I mentioned already the UK that is thinking about a lot of new mechanisms. If you look at France, they have, if you look, recent legislation in regard to biodiversity, the idea of biodiversity offsets, the whole concept of net gain on biodiversity. If you look in Australia on new ideas developing, for example, one is reef credits, which is really credits that are given to agriculture projects that reduce the runoff into the ocean. The runoff is one of the contributors to the bleaching of the reef. So if you think about all of those opportunities, we felt it was actually a good idea to start with developed markets.
One of the most recent well-regarded, well-covered in the media's academic reviews on this space is Professor Siddhartha Dasgupta's review, which recently made headlines on his assessment of the economics of biodiversity. Do you think this academic and more general widespread public attention to the topic of natural capital, does this help what you're trying to do in the CAM team and also raise investor awareness as well?
Well, if you look at history, and if you look how it was for climate, and you have the Stern Review, and I think it gave a lot of push. It obviously took a long time for the Stern Review to be really taken up by the market. And I think what we can only hope for is that now the Gupta Review, which lays out in similar, stark and clear terms what needs to be done and what the issue is from an economic perspective by, you know, not treating biodiversity in the way we should do it, that actually leads to change. Now, those reports don't give you an exact blueprint what you need to do, and I think quite deliberately. So I think it's up for us now, for the practitioners, to take this and saying to use the, let's say, the very clear headlines, as you said, that are coming out of these reports, and in order to then structure investment products around that actually help achieving what this report is telling us we should do.
Something that I really took home was his point around the fact that we're all asset managers and nature is the asset. It's our greatest resource for economic growth, and we shouldn't disregard it, which is obviously really important.
there's an interesting discussion that comes out of that, whether as an investor should actually see this as an asset, and when you do your analysis, whether this should actually come into that analysis. And I think that is lacking, right? So often, and this is even in the scope of review, there's a small section focusing on fiduciary duty, right? What is a fiduciary duty at the moment of an investor? Is it really to maximize the return in the world we see it as today, or is the fiduciary duty to actually look into the future and see and take, for example, some of the headlines from this report into account? And I think if this is going to happen, then I think investment decisions will look quite different going forward. And when we're obviously not there yet on natural capital, but when you look at climate, how it actually has changed and what this change is now leading to also in investment decisions, then we can only imagine what we can expect on natural capital.
The definition of fiduciary duty is becoming more and more holistic, as it should be, to try and integrate all of these extra concerns and factors that investors should be integrating into their investment decisions. Again, looking forward on the natural capital space as it evolves over the next 5 to 10 years, do you anticipate any challenges to further growth? How do you see the landscape evolving?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, you mentioned, and the scope of the report mentioned, that half of our GDP is somewhat linked to nature. So even a small internalization of the externalities of nature would offer a massive investment opportunity. Just think about it, right? So I think the analogy is really now when you think about carbon, the moment you put a price on carbon, then investment decisions look different. And we're seeing now the changes slowly trickling through when it comes to coal, when it comes to oil and gas. So I think there you can see it. Now imagine we would have a price on biodiversity, but here lies a little bit also the problem and the challenges. We don't have this one indicator as we have it on the climate side, right? On the climate side, we have CO2. We know that is exactly the indicator that will be what we have to reduce. And we also now have a target by how much we have to reduce it to either stay somewhere between 1.5 and 2 in temperature increase. At the moment, we don't have that equivalent there. So I think that is in a way the challenge, that it remains not defined enough in order to really have a clear path forward what needs to be done. But then I'm actually quite hopeful over the next 5 to 10 years that there will be a lot more schemes, maybe on a more local level, that will then actually really assess, okay, how can new forms of financing, for example, in regard to green infrastructure be integrated? And you don't have to internalize too many of the externalities that the scope outline to imagine that this could be an enormous market.
You briefly touched on the difference between natural capital and climate change, you know, having this one tangible element of carbon emissions, and also the 1.5 to 2 degrees pathways, which we're hopefully aiming for with significant adaptation and mitigation. And obviously, there's been a lot of press around the carbon price as well, and the EU ETS has been trading close to all-time highs of €40 currently. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the development of carbon markets and pricing more globally, and how this maybe impacts your work and also your proposed strategy relating to carbon credits.
Well, I think generally speaking, we do see that there are quite a few drivers for carbon pricing. I think the trouble is there's not really a single market in the world where there's one price. So let's be honest with that. But I think on carbon, it is particularly challenging to really say, okay, what are the different prices? So for example, you said ETS was trading €40, all-time high. Does this mean this has an impact on carbon pricing in other parts of the world? And it unfortunately doesn't really, because it depends always how those schemes are structured, right? And the ETS is structured in a very particular way that now leads to these prices. So I think we have to look a little bit into, like, if we looked in the general trends, then I think we do see a few trends. And one is we have now, and we talked about it earlier, the voluntary action from quite a few companies, net zero targets. Net zero targets doesn't mean that they all want to buy offsets, but it is a legitimate part of a strategy once all other options have been explored. And when you look at some of the companies that made targets, they actually have quite large gaps, which they will have to fill. And they are actively looking now to find ways to actually fill the gaps and either purchase credits, or a lot of them really want to actually finance projects on the ground that then also achieve other impacts than just carbon. So the voluntary side of the market is a huge driver that is at the moment also driving voluntary carbon market prices. Then you have, on the other hand, the bigger picture. There's this whole, the EU is one of the few markets where carbon, at least for nearly half of the emission, is priced in through an emissions trading scheme. Other markets don't have that, but companies are looking at, let's say, the regulatory landscape and saying, well, there is a possibility that it's going to happen. So they're also saying, how can I now prepare for that? And one of the other things that many companies are seeing as part of their net zero strategy, they have a much better handle on what actually their exposure, so to speak, is and how many tons of carbon they would actually have to acquire if they have to be net zero. And then there's the possibility under the Paris Agreement to also build in a mechanism to allow countries to trade and also to pass this on through a mechanism potentially to either regional schemes or even companies. And this is the Article 6 under the Paris Agreement. And so obviously a lot of people are looking at this, and this is driving now a lot of activity in this market. I think the way we see it, there is demand for high quality carbon credits. There are not that many projects. So when you really start looking around, there is a real need to finance good projects on the ground that can generate carbon offsets or carbon credits from whatever way you're looking at it. And we actually think, because we are, as I said at the beginning, we are fully or only focused on nature-based solutions. We do believe that nature-based solutions offer a great opportunity for projects that A, can really help companies then to credibly offset some of the emissions, and then B, also have other co-benefits or impacts that really make those projects stand out.
Looking more holistically at carbon pricing and also putting a price on natural capital, which, as you mentioned, is, one could argue, maybe more difficult because there's so many more considerations to factor in, one could argue, than carbon pricing, which has already been done to some extent, although, as you mentioned, it depends on the market because EU ETS is a very specific scheme. Do you think that they're equally important in their attempt to internalize negative or positive externalities?
Yeah, I think the moment I would argue it's obviously still much more straightforward to put a price on carbon. And that doesn't necessarily mean emissions trading scheme, right? It could be a carbon tax, there could be other the hybrids between the two of them. There's so many ways you can do that. It is relatively straightforward though from a regulatory perspective. So you have two options, right? You do a tax, which is basically you're saying you're taxing a certain amount with an unknown outcome in regard to emissions, or you're saying I want to be sure on the outcome that the emission reductions achieve, and then I put emissions trading scheme in, and the price is a variable part of it. So that's pretty straightforward. On nature, it's trickier because there's so many interlinkages on nature. We don't only have this one indicator such as CO2 that we have to factor on. There are interrelations, interdependencies that actually could have some unintended consequences. So I think one has to be a bit more careful on that. But I do think, though, is that you can do it really in regional markets, in local markets. That's, for example, when you think about watersheds, within watersheds, you can achieve fantastic things where you can basically allow entities to trade allocations between that. So that I think we obviously need to find new forms for natural capital. I can't see that we are anywhere close to have like a form of a trading scheme, but I do think there's huge opportunities to put a price on certain aspects of natural capital to create outcomes in a more efficient way.
And you mentioned a focus upon regional and local markets there, which, as you stressed, is really important for natural capital. How would you align that with more holistic national, international initiatives for this?
Look, this is really what I think the policy community is grappling with, right? So can we have a Paris moment for biodiversity, right? We're still waiting now for the new date for the Convention on Biodiversity to find a new date for its COP15, but it was supposed to happen last year now. It was supposed to happen in May, but it looks to be further postponed. So many observers were looking for a Paris moment there, but I think it's difficult to think through what would be that Paris moment, what should actually be the outcome. Maybe we have to come to a conclusion where we're saying, maybe we should come to a conclusion what we don't want to do any longer. What are the practices we want to stop in a way? So when you look, for example, on agriculture practices, on some practice in regard to forestry, in regard to deforestation. So if you could agree on that, maybe that would be a way forward. And that, by the way, would then drive huge change, right? So changes in, let's say, going into different forms of agriculture would then obviously have a huge change for this sector with huge investments that are required in order to implement them. And by the way, also with huge positive impact on biodiversity and nature in general. So maybe that is the way forward. But it's an extremely difficult question to answer at this stage. A little bit on the adaptation side, we have the same discussions in the policy community, like what is the indicator that we want to achieve, right? And it's just not one, that's the issue.
Obviously, it's not something to be solved overnight, but it's really interesting to know that it's obviously such a hot topic and definitely the subject of a lot of discussion right now. And just turning on to something which has also been the topic of climate finance and investment, which is the blue economy. I understand that you worked upon this a little bit at the EIB and that also in potential on a high level formed some of your strategies for HSBC Pollination CAM. And would you be able to speak about why you feel like the blue economy is so important and what you worked on in the past in this space?
Yeah, so it's true. The EIB is still working actually quite a bit on that, on different initiatives on the blue economy. I think it was really mainly driven by the issue of plastic in the oceans a few years back, but then more and more people looking at this and then really realizing the importance of the blue economy. And similar to what we're doing with nature now, when you look, I mean, this is part of the descriptive review, but when you look at more the terrestrial problem, we have the same in the blue economy that we're really going backwards on, and we're having a resource which should actually be endless, but we're actually treating it in a way that we're depleting it by the day. And that has very negative consequences, not only because some animals may suffer, but also really from an economic perspective. There's a huge importance of the blue economy to the wider global economy. Yeah, the EIB has done it in different ways. They supported some pilot projects into fisheries. Aquaculture is obviously one of the big issues, but they actually looked a lot when it comes to the plastic side, and I think it makes completely sense, is that they looked actually at larger scale coastal infrastructure, so particularly related to waste. When you look at the plastic problem, the problem is actually not a coastal problem. The problem is usually coming more from further inland where there is no proper waste management, and then via rivers and other means, the plastic goes into the ocean. And so they are spending a lot of money on large-scale infrastructure projects globally on that, and that makes completely sense. I think from our campsite, we do see the blue economy as actually a subset, obviously, of natural capital, but also for the carbon side as actually an extremely important sector. So on the carbon side, for example, I think that when you look at opportunities in mangrove, planting mangroves is a very significant opportunity with huge CO2 mitigation potential on the one hand side, but also with huge resilience opportunities for mangroves, obviously. And when, if you ever studied adaptation, I think the first thing you would be taught is that you should plant mangroves. So I think there are a lot of benefits. And then obviously that you can plant them in areas that are generally not really inhabited. So there are actually today some opportunities. And then the other one I find personally really interesting, and I'm sure this will grow furthermore, is the whole questions of seaweeds or kelp. So it's really planting seaweeds that then not only actually, on the one hand side, it's a mitigation strategy. They absorb CO2, but they are also really improving the situation underground. So you look at the SDG 14, the land underwater, and they really allow also to increase in species underwater, which obviously then have also huge positive impacts on biodiversity. So I think that there are opportunities. They are probably not as mature at the moment as some of the, let's say, more terrestrial, in particular natural capital opportunities, but it is definitely something that many people are looking at, and I'm sure there will be more and new ideas coming in the future.
Absolutely. It's a really interesting space, and definitely, as you mentioned, the potential for coastal protection and also carbon sequestration. I was also curious, do you think that CAM might potentially look at a strategy focused on the blue economy? It's early days at the moment.
I think it's early days. I think we have to be honest, we have a lot on our plate. We would really now like to focus first on a wider natural capital strategy. I would not exclude that. And I think there are lots of good ideas for blue economy funds or other vehicles out there. But I think at the moment, as a standalone, we would rather say let's integrate it in the existing strategies that we're having.
That makes sense. And just finally, turning to a couple of concluding questions, which we aim to ask all our guests on the podcast. Do you have any words of advice for any of our listeners who might be interested in a career in environmental finance and or potentially natural capital like yourself?
Yes, well, first of all, if you're really interested in making a career out of that, I think it's a very good time to get into this. I think more and more companies are looking at this. I think what's interesting, and I had this when I started straight out of university in the carbon market. The nice thing, I think, for a starter now in this market is even the most experienced professionals, they're also beginners. They have a lot of experience. They have probably what their advantages. They have seen a lot of other things, and that helps them obviously to put this maybe into relationship to other things. But in the end, we're all kind of really beginners in this, especially when it comes to natural capital. So it's an exciting time to get into this. And my advice would try to get as much practical experience and try to get different experience. So it doesn't always have to be on the finance side. I think a lot of people that are dealing in this field are coming through actually, let's say, much more also the project development and having some hands-on experience on the ground. And having seen a project, having been in countries with high biodiversity, that really helps as well.
That's really helpful and insightful for our listeners. And just one final question. If our listeners could take away one thing from this episode of the IB Green Minds podcast, what would you want it to be?
Well, if they haven't been convinced that natural capital or nature as an investment will only grow, then I would be disappointed.
Thanks so much, Martin. That's a very good point to end on. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Phoebe.